Election 1972 has become history. Those of us who were prepared to settle down for a long evening watching the computers, the reports, had to settle for a good night's sleep. The Luddites among us who hoped that the computers would prove themselves wrong, they somehow both fascinate us and frighten us, had to admit that sometimes they seem to know what we are going to do better than we know ourselves. I, of course, was particularly interested in those measurements of political alienation, voter alienation, about which we spoke on First Friday. And I was intrigued to discover that I was not so wrong after all, when it turned out that hardly more than one in two adult Americans had even bothered to vote. Soon, 1972, the election oratory and the vote results will be filed away on shelves, the must and dust of archives. But before that happens, I think it's important for us particularly to take one final look at a unique feature of the 1972 elections. Take a hard look at the surfacing of, in these elections, of a kind of agonized concern on all parts with what we as Jews were going to do, how we were going to vote, what shifts were going to take place in our traditional allegiances and party loyalties. But this was a truly unique feature of this election. Never before in American political history has so much time and effort been invested in sedulously seeking out, cultivating the Jewish vote, nor has so much lineage and airtime been spent analyzing the shifts, or the apparent, what was then the apparent shift in Jewish party loyalties. I was intrigued from the very beginning by this phenomenon because the numbers didn't add up to the degree of concern. From Miami to November, from the two political conventions to the election, the polls were reporting to us that there was never less than a 22, 24, 26 point spread between the president who was running for re-election and Senator McGovern. Now, each one of these points adds up to about 1 million voters. But there was always a difference of some 22 to 26 million American votes between the National Republican ticket and the National Democratic ticket. The Jewish vote represents some 3 million potential electors. Whenever the polls discussed the so-called shift of Jewish loyalties and interests from the Democratic column to the Republican column, they never talked of a shift of more than 15% of the total vote. In 1968, we had voted approximately 85% for Senator Humphrey and about 15% for Mr. Nixon. No one, no poll indicated that at the very most, the change would be more than one where 60% of the Jewish vote would vote for Senator McGovern and some 40% would vote for President Nixon. And that reduces to about 350,000 votes. Now, when one puts 350,000 votes or 400,000 votes against 20 million votes, the number is reduced to insignificance. And the question surfaces, why? Why was Mr. Gallup, why was Sam Lubell and all the others so interested in this particular shift? There were so many others. What was involved? Why was it so important what the Jewish housewife in a supermarket in Milwaukee was saying about the future president of the United States? She said, in effect, that it was costing her too much to shop. Now, the pundits, the analysts, explained this interest on three bases. The first, they said, was that the Jews had moved from a position of an immigrant first-generation group into one which was second-generation and middle class, and they were interested in seeing how acclimatized we were to our new assumed prosperity, how much we were going to vote the pocketbook, middle-class interests, against the traditional immigrant concerns to move into an open and free America. But more to the point, according to the pollsters, were two uniquely or particularly parochial Jewish interests. The first had to do with the seeming isolationism which was emerging in the Democratic camp, Come Home America, the projects which the senator was putting forth to reduce our troop commitments in Europe, to reduce the strength of our 7th Fleet in the Mediterranean, and the possible implications of this policy, including his oft-spoken increased dependence of American policy on the United Nations, the results of this, potential results of this, as far as Americans' vital or vigorous support of the defense needs of Israel were concerned. And the third issue, again one of specific Jewish concern, though it concerned many other white ethnic groups, had to do with the emerging quota system in American political and occupational life, affirmative action and all that it meant. There's hardly a Jew above the age of 35 who, in terms of employment, in terms of education, has not met up with a quota system and felt himself denied some opportunity because of a numerus clausus, because he was one of a numbered minority, because he was being judged by some label other than his professional competence. And here was a candidate who had come to his nomination as a presidential candidate on the basis of a national party reform where the quota system was the basis of the reform, and who seemed to have promised most of the labeled minorities, the blacks, the Mexican-American women, and so on, that they would receive positions at the highest levels of government specifically commensurate with their numbers in the society. And that there was a sensitivity, a peculiar sensitivity, given our past experience among Jews, to the danger of raising again a quota system in the United States from which we, as a very small minority, would be particularly disadvantaged. And there was this kind of analysis throughout the American press. You read it as well as I. While the national press, the media, analyzed the Jewish movement, our own Jewish press moralized about it. And there were a series of newspaper sermons, poor sermons at that, which tended to pound the editorial pen and berate us because presumably those who were shifting were deserting the cause of righteousness, the liberal cause, the only group which had Jewish interests truly at heart. We were deserting Jewish values, concerned with civil rights, concerned with human values, concerned with welfare rights, for the pocketbook and for selfish interests. And on the other hand, there were another group of columnists among us who moralized to the effect that it was not so much that Jews were deserting the righteous cause, the liberal cause, but that the righteousness, the liberal cause, had deserted the Jews. And that in order to make certain changes which were deemed necessary for the American polity, they'd come to the position where these could be achieved only by a quota system. The means, the end had come to the position where it justified any means, and that the suburban liberal was now prepared and willing to let the Jewish poor, the Jewish school teacher, the Jewish social worker, the Jewish elderly pay the price of their own liberal pronouncements and philosophies. The debate was highly moral and highly unenlightening. And so it went. The vote came, and Jews voted, And we did indicate by our votes a shift in our areas of concern, in our loyalties. The quota issue was a real issue. Many Jews were not prepared to be the scapegoats, the people who paid the price for other people's principles. Interestingly, it was not so much the wealthier Jew who deserted the so-called liberal cause, but it was the poorer Jew, the Jew whose most immediate interests were threatened, whose children might not have the advantage that hard work and persistence might give them. They had no power, no privilege, no entree which could open doors for them. They needed freedom, the meritocracy, which has been heretofore the basis of American democracy. They felt themselves, you know, beleaguered and besieged, and for one reason or another, for better or for worse, with good judgment or bad. It was precisely among these middle, lower middle class groups, the blue collar Jew, that the shift took place from the Democratic camp to the Republican camp, at least on a national level. All this is history, and all this has been much commented on. What has not been commented on is the fallacy of the argument from the very beginning. And it's to that point that I'd like to turn our attention this morning. Politicians and political analysts love to consider themselves a hard-boiled, calculating, and realistic breed. It's the only group I know where it pays to be a mumser. You look hard, and you look calculating, and you're rather proud of it. Now, what made them believe at the beginning of this election that, if we can use the word Jewish power in quotation marks, would be so significant in 1972? Three calculations, I think, went up into this particular concatenation of ideas. The first was the size and the placement of the Jewish vote. We represent between 2.7 and 3% of the total American polity, at least the total polity who are old enough to vote. Yet when it comes to actual vote casts, we represent some 5% of those who actually vote. The importance of the Jewish vote is magnified by our willingness to exercise our democratic prerogative and the lethargy of many other elements and segments of the population. But more than this, Senator McGovern was campaigning on the basis of a specific strategy. He said, in effect, at the very beginning of his campaign that he was writing off the Farm Belt states, the southern states, that he was concentrating on the great industrial states of the nation, which had the bulk electoral vote, and it's precisely in those states, particularly in the big cities of those states, that the urban Jewish population is concentrated. If we are 3% of the population and 5% of those who actually vote, in New York and in California, we reach close to 9% of those who actually vote. And in Pennsylvania and in Illinois and in Massachusetts, states of this kind, we represent a significant, smallish, but a significant minority of those who will actually make the decision. So it seemed to the political analysts that on the basis of our geography, of our demographic geography, there was a particular significance to the Jewish vote. And secondly, they argued that if there would be a shift in Jewish party interest on the national or presidential level, and if this shift was where they thought it would be, largely among the richer Jews who had made it and now would be assumed to be more conservative, there might be a significant stemming of contributions into the Democratic coffers. Political elections in the United States have become terribly costly. The Republican Party has always been able to depend upon the richest elements in the population to pay its campaign budgets. The Democratic Party, which has tried to place itself in the position of being the champions of the ordinary people, has not had as many rich people in support of it, of its candidates. Jews have made it. Many Jews who come out of laboring class, blue class, immigrant class origins, and they've understood heretofore the call of the Democratic Party and its principles, and they've been willing to contribute significantly to its coffers. And it was believed by these analysts that if this shift did take place, many of those who had contributed to Senator Humphrey and others in the past would be unwilling to make similar contributions to Senator McGovern in 1972. And the third argument which was raised was the argument of so-called Jewish influence. We are assumed by the international myth to have an influence beyond our numbers, to be powerful beyond any reality that exists. And there is the operative in the minds of many the idea that somehow Jews, because we tend to be a literate people, because many of our people have gone into writing, into the world of the newspaper, the world of reporting, that somehow we exert an inordinate, coordinated political influence in the United States. And I don't know how many of you were watching TV that night, but I saw one beautiful example of this kind of stereotypic thinking. It happened on ABC. It happened about 9:30 in the evening. There was very little to report. It was very clear what was going to happen, and the local issues were not really pouring in as yet. And a man who I really had never seen before got up in front of the microphone and began to talk about the assumed influence of the Eastern establishment in the domination of the media. And it was interesting. Eastern establishment is a code word in many ways, you know, for the Eastern New York Jew. And what he said was this. He said, now, there's been claimed that we are unduly influenced in certain ways by all being from this Eastern establishment. Howard Smith is from a small town in California. And Harry Reasoner is from another small town in the South. And I come from a very small town you've never heard about in Arizona. And somehow this was proof of what? That the three of them weren't Jewish, that there was no Jewish influence in the media, and that somehow all these claims, which were obviously the unspoken assumption of Jew power, in quotation marks, 1972, in fact, had little, if any, reality. Now, these were the assumptions. And one by one, these assumptions were exploded in the results of last Tuesday. If all the Jews in the United States had voted for Senator McGovern Tuesday last, Senator McGovern would not have won any other state but little Massachusetts that he in fact did win. In no state was the Jewish vote sufficiently pivotal to have brought that state from the Republican to the Democratic column. Our votes were simply not that important. And on the level of campaign contributions, if in fact there was a diminution of Jewish money into the Democratic campaign, it hardly hurt the fiscal soundness of that campaign. In 1968, when Senator Humphrey had a relative unanimous approval among Jews, and when a great deal of the money which supported Senator Humphrey was in fact from Jewish sources, that campaign was $8 billion in the red and remains in the red to this day. And whatever else it was, however unsuccessful Senator McGovern's campaign without this presumed source of money, it ended up in the black. He didn't spend any less money, but there was more money to spend. Jewish money, in other words, if there be such, simply didn't make that kind of difference. And the Jewish press, well, that international conspiracy represented by the Jewish press, represented somehow by the New York Times, the newspaper that I, for one, wish were far more Jewish than, in fact, it is. The New York Times is one of the very few major papers in the United States that came out for Senator McGovern. And New York City, for the first time since 1924, voted for a Republican presidential candidate. So much for Jewish influence. Now, we nod our heads rather approvingly, but there's some rather frightening consequences of the shattering of this myth. And it's to these that I now want to turn our attention. For it seems to me that 1972 ought to be, if politics is the clear-headed, shrewd, cold business that politicians like to make it out to be, it's patently evident that the myth of Jewish power will never again in the United States be the kind of operative myth that it was in this campaign. We'll have our votes, and we'll make our contributions to those we want to make our contributions to, and we'll discuss whether there are specific interests, a specific Jewish concern. But on the national level, I doubt that ever again there'll be that much made over the Jewish vote the Jewish influence. And if politicians take the time, there'll be added reasons than simply the results of 1972. In 1946, we Jews represented 3.2% of the American population. In 1972, we represent 2.7% of the American population. As a group, we have one of the lowest birth rates of any group in the American polity. There are two-thirds of the youngsters who are between 10 and 15 exist as youngsters between 0 and 5. There's been a one-third drop in a five-year age band. In the last 5 years, the statistics are simply this. We Jews are not increasing, we're not even reproducing ourselves. That's point number one. And point number two is that the era where Jews were tended to be found in self-made and successful business enterprises, where the owner can do pretty much what he wants, he is beholden to no one but himself, he is a free political agent, and he has made a good profit in good times, which he's willing to invest, if he wishes, in a political candidate or a political party, that era too is coming to an end. Inflation is taking care of part of it. Taxes are taking care of part of it. But more importantly, fewer and fewer Jews are individual entrepreneurs. More and more of us are salaried employees of institutions. And we are being overlaid by all the cautions, all the limitations which employment, institutional responsibility require. We've only to look among ourselves to recognize the truth of this. What's for it then? What does it mean? What are the implications of this loss? It's hardly the way to phrase it. Of the lack of Jewish power in the United States. Because I don't believe we ever had the power. But I think some of us deluded ourselves to believe that we did. What are the consequences? Well, one of the consequences, I believe, is a very practical one. I read to you deliberately this morning the portion which is the assigned portion of the week in the synagogue. It's not a very edifying portion. It's about a woman who conceives and she has twins, and twins get in an argument and one does the other in. But it's typical of the Bible. It deals with a father and a mother, the desire to have children and the generations. Religion, spiritual ideas, do not exist in a vacuum. They're internalized by people. The Bible is unique among the great religious scriptures, and that doesn't attempt to preach. It describes a history. The hegira of a great spiritualized nation. It's as a people that Jews made a contribution to the world. It's not because we've made a few great vague pronouncements, which people have repeated from platforms ever since. It's in a specific context as part of a specific people that we bring the light of God, the tradition of the Bible, alive to the world. And you need bodies. You need people. And there's a critical mass. We've always been a small people, but there's a critical mass, a point beyond which assimilation must inevitably override and erase a Jewish polity. What that number is, no one quite knows. But I wonder if we as Jews do not have a peculiar way, necessarily peculiar way of looking at all of the present propaganda for birth control and population zero, which we, by the way, tend to be among the foremost champions. Look, 1 in 3 of the Jews who were alive when I was born was blotted out in the Holocaust. It's not simply a matter of American political clout. It's a matter of needing people who will participate with us in retaining and sustaining one of the most exciting, one of the most catalyzing, one of the most enlightened religious traditions that man has ever developed. From our loins have come Jews, and the Bible, and the Talmud, and the Midrash, all that we represent. From our loins have come Christianity and Islam. From our loins have come the modern cults, the economic cults of the day, the psychiatric cults of the day. We Jews have been a constant source of ideas of enlightenment to the world. But we need numbers. And I wonder if it is not, in some ways, an act of disloyalty to the memory of the many, the one in three, who were slaughtered and died as martyrs, not to at least produce enough youngsters to carry on, to continue. And I think we as Jews must rethink our own responsibilities in terms of withdrawal and out-marriage. One of the problems of Jewish life in America is everyone has made a fetish of openness, of being receptive to any ideas, of freedom of choice. And all these are good and valid goals. And they're certainly defendable moral positions. But don't we as Jews here too have a particular, you know, group responsibility? We need young Jews. We need loyal Jewish families. We need to sustain the critical mass without which these laws, all that this congregation represents, all that 4,000 years of history represents, somehow is canceled, diminished, and ultimately erased. But more than numbers, we Jews, it seemed to me, need to be concerned with two other values which we have tended to set aside in the past generation. The first is the value of a steady, stubborn, and loving loyalty. And the second is the value of consecration, of commitment. Let me try and explain both. Steady, persevering, loving loyalty. Loyalty to a faith. Loyalty to its institutions. Loyalty to its people. Not simply the loyalty which is a loyalty to general human values, we teach those too, but loyalty to the parochial, loyalty to that which involves just ourselves, loyalty to that which allows us to become and gives us the capacity to create the institutions which will enlighten, which will teach, which will transmit, which will pass on, which will encourage and which will enlighten. We need to be loyal. To be loyal, we need to be informed. To be loyal, we need to be part of a grand religious experience. Not spectators, not an occasional financial participant, but we need to live as Jews and to bring Jewish life into the context of our daily life and into our families. And then we need quality. We need consecration. We need involvement. We can have influence. The influence which comes out of capacity, out of hard work, out of being the one who is able and ready to do the job when the job needs to be done. But in the last generation, we Jews have become slack and lax. We've taken up the philosophy of leisure, of dropping off and dropping away and forgetting to keep our eyes on some kind of personal goal. How many young Jewish boys and girls have dropped out of school and are floating as flotsam on the seas of life, here and there, experiencing. Or the word is living. Really, the word is floating, vegetating. What will they have to offer this great nation of ours when the time comes when they ought to be putting their shoulder to the wheel? A skill? A profession? A disciplined mind? Enlightenment? Or some kind of private inner experience? They've seen many colors in a vision. But what use is that to the social welfare of this country? They've had a great high. How will that raise our civilization higher? We need to somehow maintain, recapture that sense of dedication to quality. Some of our fathers called Torah, and some of our fathers called Avoda, which was among them the determination to do all that they could to take advantage of whatever opportunity this country offered. I'm not a prophet nor the son of a prophet, but I would believe this, that this country will offer less opportunity to Jews rather than more opportunity to Jews in the predictable future. When an idea like the quota system is first suggested, and when many minorities see great opportunity, if only they can seize on it and make it seem respectable, and not simply, you know, an end which will cost somebody something, that kind of idea has a longish political history. It doesn't disappear quickly. And it isn't simply an idea which is, you know, opposed by one party and validated by another. It's the Republican administration of President Nixon, which has been the first to apply the quota system and a series of demands made of all institutions, receiving public funds. There'll be quotas, overt and covert. And it's the young Jew coming from a smallish minority who will be one of the first who will suffer from these quotas. And if that young person is not better trained, a Jew, a harder worker, a Jew, more indefatigable, a Jew, what opportunity will really be his? Now, what am I describing? I'm describing the immemorial diaspora experience of the Jew, Galut. I'm describing what it means to be an American Jew, not an Israeli Jew. To be a Jew who is a part of a small minority who are ultimately dependent upon a political will which they cannot control or dominate or make to do all that they wish it to do. I'm describing not the dream we have of America, but the coming reality in America. I'm describing a Jew which we had hoped, many of us, we would not have to be, and certainly our children would not have to be. We wanted normalcy. We wanted to be as lazy and as lethargic and as indulgent and as leisure-loving as everyone else. And the simple truth is that after 1972, we can't afford to be. The Bible put it this way, "Not by power nor by might, but by my spirit, saith the Lord." We can't play the power game. We can't play the game of influence. We can play the game of the mind, the game of consecration, the game of quality, the game of spirit. 1972 signals a new age. And I hope and pray that we Jews still have the Jewish courage for it. Amen.